This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Claire McDonnell, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 8th of September, these are our main stories. A senior British cabinet minister, Amber Rudd, has resigned, accusing the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, of an assault on decency and democracy over his handling of Brexit. President Trump is being investigated for an alleged conflict of interest involving increased US military spending at an airport near one of his golf courses in Scotland. Ukraine's president has hailed an exchange of dozens of prisoners with Russia as a possible first step towards ending the war in the East. Also in this podcast...
The world is not okay. It's not just nice films, we love movies. But we also have to say there is a climate crisis. We have to do something right now.
Climate change activists have held a sit-in on the final day of the Venice Film Festival. Let's begin with a senior member of the British government resigning in a new blow to the authority of the Brexit-seeking Prime Minister Boris Johnson. Amber Rudd said Mr Johnson's decision to expel 21 Conservative MPs from the party for voting against his Brexit policy in Parliament earlier this week was an assault on decency and democracy. Ms Rudd, who voted for Britain to remain in the European Union in the 2016 referendum, announced her resignation in a statement to the Sunday Times newspaper. Our political correspondent Jonathan Blake reports.
Amber Rudd has served at the heart of government. She campaigned to remain in the EU referendum and was Home Secretary under Theresa May. She survived the clear-out of like-minded colleagues when Boris Johnson became Prime Minister and was made Work and Pension Secretary, among others, almost all Brexiteers. Just this week, Amber Rudd expressed concern about the Prime Minister's strategy of throwing MPs out of the party for voting against the government.
I think we have some very valued colleagues who have made a very different choice.
In her letter to the Prime Minister, Amber Rudd said resigning was a difficult decision, but wrote, "I do not believe that leaving with a deal is the government's main objective." The government is expending a lot of energy, she wrote, to prepare for no deal, but I have not seen the same level of intensity going into our talks with the European Union, who have asked us to present alternative arrangements to the Irish backstop.
I knew and I accept that the Prime Minister should be able to leave no deal on the table. But what I had expected to see was a huge government-centred effort to get a deal. And at the moment, there is a lot of work going on into no deal and not enough going into getting a deal. And then on top of that, I've seen 21 of my colleagues, good, strong, conservative MPs with true, moderate, progressive values, excluded from the party.
Amber Rudd's resignation will come as a blow to Boris Johnson at a critical time for his premiership. Her reasons reflect the concerns others in government share.
Jonathan Blake with that report. President Trump is being investigated for an alleged conflict of interest which involves increased US military spending at Prestwick Airport in Scotland and visits by aircrew to his nearby Turnberry Golf Resort. The United States Congress is considering whether the claims amount to a violation of the American Constitution. Graham Stewart reports.
The House Oversight Committee claims that US military spending at Prestwick Airport has increased substantially since Donald Trump's election as president in 2016. The newly revealed investigation, which has been underway for several months, cites newspaper reports which allege the airport provided discounted rooms to some US military crew and free rounds of golf at Trump's Turnberry Resort, which is situated 20 miles from Prestwick. There has been no response from the US government. Both the airport and Trump Turnberry have operated at significant losses in recent years. The Scottish Government, which took the airport into public ownership 6 years ago, says it operates on a commercial basis and at arm's length from ministers. In June, it announced the airport was being put up for sale.
Graham Stewart. The Netherlands says it regrets the release by Russia of a Ukrainian separatist allegedly implicated in the shooting down of a Malaysian passenger plane in 2014. He was one of 70 detainees exchanged by Russia and the Ukraine earlier on Saturday. The Dutch government said his release could compromise the investigation into the shooting down of flight MH17 from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur. Ukraine described the swap as a first step towards ending the war in the East. Russia called it a very important step. Well, one of those released, Kirill Vyshinsky, is a Russian journalist and told reporters how he felt after landing at Vnukovo Airport near Moscow.
Honestly, for more than a year, I haven't been so nervous as in the past week. In prison, everything becomes so plain. The days turn into just days between court hearings. Everything around is grey, indifferent.
Well, at Kiev airport, there were emotional reunions. I spoke to our correspondent, Jonah Fisher, who is in the Ukrainian capital, and asked him for more details about the prisoners who were freed.
Well, from the Ukrainian point of view, all of the most high-profile and sensitive Ukrainians who are being held in Russia have been released. So that includes the 24 Ukrainian sailors who were captured off the coast of Crimea in November of last year, and 11 civilians, if you like, who were detained for various different reasons over the last 5 years or so. The most high-profile of those cases is Oleg Sentsov, a filmmaker who was detained in Crimea in 2014 and was then put on trial and sentenced to about 20 years in prison on terrorism charges. Heading the other direction, and this is the more interesting one in a sense, is, 35 individuals, but one that has really been focused on, called Vladimir Semak. He is a Ukrainian separatist, and he is potentially a witness to the events around the downing of MH17, the passenger jet that was shot down in eastern Ukraine in 2014. We know that Dutch investigators would rather the Ukrainians hadn't handed him over, but over the last week or so, it's been pretty clear that he was the sticking point holding up this large-scale exchange. And in the end, Ukraine seems to have decided that if they wanted to get this deal done, Mr. Semak had to be part of the exchange, and he has indeed headed to Moscow today.
So then why are some analysts saying this is a win for the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky?
Well, it does feel like quite a big win for him. He was at the airport to receive the 35 men back onto Ukrainian soil. He has made getting these men released one of his core election promises throughout this year. He's a newly elected president here in Ukraine. And I think he has an appreciation that until he got this prisoner issue resolved, if you like, that there was really no way that he could try and engage in the bigger project, which is trying to resolve the conflict in eastern Ukraine and try and improve relations with Russia. So when he was on the tarmac, he spoke to journalists and I asked him in English whether this would actually improve relations with Russia.
We did two connections, telephone connections between two presidents. We have done the first step. We have to begin all the steps publicly. I hope we'll have the nearest meeting and we'll speak about it. We have to do all the steps to finish this horrible war.
So, Jonah, how far do people think this swap will go to rebuilding confidence between Russia and Ukraine? Because it seems to have set the stage for more serious talks.
Well, I think rebuilding confidence is a bit too strong a word, but I think it has opened a door, not particularly wide, but there is an opening and a door for discussions to now to take place at the very top level between Russia and Ukraine. President Zelensky has made this one of his priorities. He stated that ending the war will be his priority until the prisoner issue was taken out of the way. It was really looking impossible for President Zelensky and President Putin to sit together in the same room and have meaningful discussions about trying to improve relations between their two countries. I think it is now likely that once this has been put to one side, we will see in the next couple of weeks moves to get President Putin and President Zelensky in the same room together, most likely in the context of what's known as the Normandy format, which is whereby the leaders of Germany and also of France get together with President Putin and President Zelensky to discuss eastern Ukraine.
Jonah Fisher reporting. Britain says it is deeply troubled by reports that an Iranian oil tanker at the centre of tensions between Tehran and the West appears to be moored off Syria. Satellite images show the vessel lying close to the port of Tartus. The tanker was seized by Gibraltar in July, but released on condition that its cargo wouldn't be sold to Syria. Our diplomatic correspondent James Landell reports.
The Iranian oil tanker, the Grace One, was detained in July by Gibraltar with the help of Royal Marines. It was suspected of heading for Syria in breach of EU sanctions, but released in August after Iran gave written assurances this was not the case. But new satellite images appear to show the tanker, now renamed Adrian Daraya 1, moored just a few miles off the Syrian port of Tartus, potentially there to offload its cargo. The chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee, Tom Tugendhat, said it was disappointing.
This is exactly why the vessel was impounded. We've known for many months that the Iranian regime is quite literally fueling the war in Syria, in this case with crude, but in other parts with weapons, ammunition and other forms of logistical support. So this is hugely disappointing and demonstrates again why the United Kingdom government was right to impound the vessel in Gibraltar and wrong to release it.
In a terse tweet clearly pointed at European allies, the US National Security Advisor John Bolton said anyone who said the Adrian Dariya 1 wasn't headed to Syria was in denial. A Foreign Office spokesman said the reports were deeply troubling and any breach of Iran's assurances would be morally bankrupt and a violation of international norms. So far, Iran has made no comment on the tanker. But it did announce a further breach of the deal agreed in 2015 to curb its nuclear program, saying its engineers would start using advanced centrifuges to enrich uranium, bringing the country one step closer to developing weapons-grade nuclear fuel. Yet again, Iran remaining defiant in a standoff with the West that few expect to be resolved soon.
James Landale. Well, Samir Mandani is co-founder of the website tankertrackers.com and has been monitoring the tanker's movements. Julia Marshall asked him, what do the latest satellite images tell us?
The latest imagery, we had a look and we saw that the Adrian Dariya is anchored off the coast of Tartus port. There is the Russian Navy terminal there. And that area has no relevance to oil. In fact, the actual oil facility is slightly north of that. And so this vessel has not reached that delivery point, and we do not believe it will go there. In fact, what we were expecting to see is another vessel, a smaller vessel, which can capacitate 1 million barrels, tether with this vessel and execute a ship-to-ship transfer of 1 million barrels. This way that the Adrian Dariya 1 can actually sail back home to Iran with at least 1 million barrels aboard. And the reason for that is because the Adrian Dariya is too heavily laden in the water for her to use the Suez Canal in her current condition. She's too deep in the water.
What makes you so convinced, though, that the Adrian Dariya is going to offload its cargo of oil?
Well, over the past year, say between August of 2018 and end of July, this year, we've seen 17 million barrels of oil be delivered to Syria via the Suez Canal. And those are usually always sent with Suezmax vessels, so 1 million barrels at a time. This is the first time we actually see a fully laden, very large crude carrier handling 2 million barrels sailing all the way around Africa to reach Syria. We've always believed that she would go to Syria, but not to deliver oil towards Syria. In fact, to use Syria as a safe haven for ship-to-ship transfers to smaller vessels.
So just to be clear, there is no evidence as of now that the Adrian Dariya is delivering oil to Syria in breach of the agreement which was made and which enabled it to be released from off the coast of Gibraltar.
As far as the Adrian Dariya 1 is concerned, it seems that Iran is holding up its end of the deal as not technically delivering the oil to Syria as of yet. We still see that the vessel is fully laden. From the reference of shadows of the imagery, we do not see that she has discharged or delivered any of her oil within Syria.
Why should the vessel, though, have undertaken what seems very much to be a very tortuous journey and to have arrived so close to Syria if it wanted to avoid suspicion that that was indeed its ultimate destination?
Well, Syria is the perfect safe haven for this vessel to do any transactions. And because we've seen previously vessels do ship-to-ship transfers in Syria's waters. And so this led us to believe that this would be the case because there is no reason for Iranian oil to sail all the way around Africa to reach Syria. But in this case, she had to because she could not use the Suez Canal. And in order for her big VLCC to use the Suez, they would have to offload 1 million barrels via a pipeline which runs from the Red Sea part of Egypt to the Mediterranean. And that pipeline is partly owned by GCC states. And Saudi Arabia would be the one that would object the most about it.
Samir Madani there from tankertrackers.com. 2 years ago, the small town of Balahadrin in the west of Ireland became home for around 200 Syrian refugees fleeing violence and chaos in their country. Across Ireland, 4,000 refugees were expected to come to the emergency reception centres and move on as quickly as possible. So, has the plan worked? Bits and Doubt reports.
In 2017, faced with a humanitarian crisis, Ireland accepted refugees from Syria as part of an EU resettlement. There were doubting voices, but many Irish people welcomed the gesture. And last year, a small rural town won an award for the warmth of its welcome.
Ladies and gentlemen, please join us in congratulating once again our community group of the year, the people of Balahadrin.
Today, about 170 migrants, mainly Syrian and of all ages, are housed in Balahadrin in the west of Ireland. They live in a modern hotel which had closed and which became one of three emergency reception and orientation centres. They're all hoping to move on to a new life elsewhere in Ireland.
For myself, as a man who's learned to trade, my intention is to set up my own business somewhere as a baker. That would benefit the country that brought me here, and I could pass on my skills to others.
Michael Mulligan is a councillor locally for the Sinn Féin party. He says bringing in refugees, assuming they'd easily find homes and new livings, was never realistic.
We have very, very poor service with the doctors. We hadn't enough teachers. We were promised all these things. We didn't get them. We were let down by the government, and, you know, the refugees were let down as well.
Abdul Rahman has been at the centre for almost a year.
I'm a father of four, and with my wife, that's six of us. We have three rooms here, and we're safe. That's the number one priority. But living here, you don't have that sense of independence. This is a good place, and we do like it. But we've been here for months, and we need to get on now with our own independent lives.
Now in her 80s, Mary Gallagher dislikes voices she's heard locally protesting at tax money being spent on foreign nationals with no Irish connection.
It's spent on people who have had everything taken from them, who have been dispossessed and put away from their own place. So what do we Irish do? Do we say, oh, I'm tough, I'm sorry. Really, it's nothing to do with us. I think, go away, ye pack of traitors. We were once those people.
Some Syrians have formally complained about how long it takes to move to social housing, but there's gratitude too, and desire to return to Damascus or Aleppo appears non-existent.
Speaking for myself, I couldn't even contemplate going back to Syria until I've paid Ireland back for all it's given me.
That's Hashem, ending that report from Vincent Dowd. Now, just a reminder about one of the BBC World Service's newest podcasts. Music Life is the podcast that puts four top musicians together in a room and gets them talking. And what we end up with is a series of fascinating insights into the lives and minds of our music stars, from the insecurities and anxieties that both stalk them to the tales of life on the road. Just search for Music Life wherever you found this podcast. Thousands of riot police have been deployed in Hong Kong to stop pro-democracy protesters shutting down transport links to the airport. Officers fought skirmishes with small groups of hardcore protesters in the Mangkok area, which has seen regular clashes. Demonstrations have continued across Hong Kong despite the much-hated proposed extradition law being revoked earlier this week. Stephen McDonnell reports now from Hong Kong.
Encouraged by what they saw as their success in causing transport chaos last weekend, Hong Kong protesters threatened to repeat this action today. However, thousands of police were used to patrol approaches to the airport, a major transport hub for Asia. Cars were stopped at police roadblocks as officers searched for activists planning to blockade train, road and bus connections. Earlier this week, Hong Kong's leader Carrie Lam announced the official withdrawal of a bill, which would have allowed for people to be extradited to mainland Chinese courts controlled by the Communist Party. But many in the pro-democracy camp have said that 3 months was too long to wait for the provision to be officially scrapped. and that they now have additional demands, like an independent inquiry into alleged police links with organised crime and genuine universal suffrage.
Stephen McDonnell in Hong Kong. Muslim rebels in the southern Philippines have begun handing over their guns as part of a peace process signed with the government. Michael Bristow has the details.
Former fighters with the Moro Islamic Liberation Front turned in nearly 1,000 weapons. President Rodrigo Duterte, who attended the handover ceremony on the island of Mindanao, said the rebels will be reintegrated into society. Each will receive $19,000 worth of cash, health insurance and training. The rebel group, the largest in the Philippines, said 40,000 fighters will be demobilised in the coming years, although other militant organisations remain active. A reminder of that came on Saturday. Just 40 kilometres from where the guns were being turned in, a bomb exploded in a market, injuring at least seven.
Michael Bristow. The rush to help thousands of Bahamians is gaining pace after the destruction caused by Hurricane Dorian. Helicopters, even cruise ships and jet skis are being used in the effort. The storm may have moved on briefly to make contact with the United States, but problems there pale into insignificance with the devastation caused in parts of northern Bahamas. According to UN relief officials, more than 70,000 people, that's virtually the entire population of the islands of Grand Bahama and Abaco, are in need of assistance. 43 people are known to have died on the two islands. Survivors have been arriving at the capital, Nassau.
Me and my family, my mom and my dad and my sisters and their kids, we all came together. We were 16 of us sleeping in a two-bedroom apartment and just trying to get by the best way we could.
To be honest, I'm thankful for life. I lost everything, my car, house, clothes, all of that is gone, but I got life, so I'm thankful. Abaco, there's plenty of people dead. Plenty of people are not found.
My eldest son, I haven't heard from him before the storm. I have reached out to the media by posting his picture, everything, and there's no listing of names or of persons who are here. You can't go to the window or anything and look at the names. There's nothing.
Well, meanwhile, the Category 2 storm is on the edge of the Canadian province of Nova Scotia with winds of 160 kilometres an hour. Already 200,000 people have lost power. Erica Fleck is Chief of Emergency Planning in Halifax.
The residents know themselves, they know their property, so we would recommend that they self-evacuate if they have nowhere else to go. But we are really concerned with the waves coming up and the storm surge that we are expecting. The good news about this storm, although I said 10 to 12 meter waves, it is coming in at low tide. And should that shift at all and it comes in at high tide, then we can expect, you know, much bigger and worsening conditions along the coast.
Erica Fleck. There's been a spate of suicides this year in the New York City Police Department. Nine officers have taken their own lives. It shocked the city and left colleagues and politicians looking for answers to explain why so many have died this way. Law enforcement is a stressful job with long hours, and it's been known for a while that suicide is a risk for officers across the United States. Courtney Subramanian reports, and some people may find the following report disturbing.
You know, I walk up and he was in his car. He was seated. And he had his phone in his lap. And I knew, you know, I just didn't want to know. And I touched him. And like I said, it was cold out. But I knew he was dead.
Just outside of Boston, Lieutenant David Betts stood in the parking lot where he found his son dead from a self-inflicted gunshot wound.
I could see in him the ability to be able to excel just by virtue of him wanting to help people.
David Betts III became a police officer, following in his father's and his grandfather's footsteps.
He was level-headed for a young kid. Aside from him being the life of the party with his friends, he would also be that guy that they would look to for help.
But at the dawn of his career, at just 24 years old, David took his own life. His father says he left no indication of his struggle to his fellow officers, friends, or family.
I always thought I was a good judge of character, being able to see things and see if somebody needs help or I should know when somebody needs help. I couldn't see it in my son. You know, so that bothers me.
Police officers experience the worst of humanity. They encounter dead bodies, traffic accidents, and in Dave's case, his own son's suicide.
Shot fired! Shot fired!
Police suicide is a nationwide epidemic.
A police force shaken by suicide.
The second NYPD suicide in 2 days.
The department is now once again mourning the loss of one of their own.
New York City has received most of the national attention.
It's beyond a challenge, it's a crisis.
New York Police Commissioner James O'Neill declared a mental health crisis in the wake of 9 officers who took their own lives this year.
We need to change the culture. We need to make sure that our police officers have access to mental health care.
At least 130 officers throughout America have died by suicide in 2019. By the end of the year, that number could exceed the 167 deaths in 2018. Researchers say police officers are at a higher risk of suicide than any other profession, a consequence of intense stress, easy access to firearms, and peer pressure to hide their emotions.
That's one of the things that has been so stigmatized amongst cops is that, you know, you don't talk about it, you just kind of suck it up and move on.
To carry on his son's legacy, Dave has teamed up with Janice to combat the stigma.
My name is Janice McCarthy. I lost my husband to suicide. He was a state police captain here in Massachusetts just over 13 years ago.
After her husband Paul's death, Janice dedicated her life to making sure help is available for officers who need it. She trains police to recognize signs of trauma in themselves and their peers.
They are caretakers. They're used to taking care of everyone else. In my experience with my husband, he was very good at taking care of the citizens. He would change flat tires. He saved premature newborn babies. He couldn't save himself because no one gave him the luxury to say, "What's wrong? Are you okay?"
But Janice and Dave want to turn that luxury into policy. They are pushing a bill that would mandate mental health police training across Massachusetts.
It would give them the tools to look within themselves and at their colleagues for signs of which they are suffering.
You know, if there's an officer listening to this piece, what's the message you want them to hear, or the message you think your husband would want them to hear?
I would want them to know that they are more than a police officer. They're a husband, they're a father, they're a son, they're a sibling, and that their life means more than this job. They have to take care of themselves.
Janice McCarthy ending that report by Courtney Subramanian. Now, several hundred climate change activists have held a sit-in on the red carpet on the final day of the Venice Film Festival, ending it before the closing ceremony to avoid a clash with security forces. They were joined by demonstrators angry at the huge cruise ships they say are damaging the very foundations of the city. Robert Sutton Mattox has more.
Venice Film Festival is used to Hollywood stars and red carpet glamour, but probably not the white boiler suit, as hundreds of activists took over and demanded climate change action.
And we tell them that the world is not okay. It's not just nice films, we love movies, but we also have to say there is a climate crisis, we have to do something right now.
Our world is sinking and burning, which we can see by what's happening in the Amazon. That's why we're here. If you put so much attention on a film festival that lasts a week, you can also put the same attention on the climate crisis.
Climate justice! Now!
Some have come from outside Italy, but there are locals here too, like the protest group No Grandi Navi, who claim cruise ships damage the foundations of this historic city. A campaign which got worldwide attention back in June when a huge cruise ship lost control when it was trying to dock and crashed into the wharf.
Also ask to the star system to take a position. So we are on the red carpet today. We will stay here. We ask them to do the red carpet with us.
The climate activists have already picked up star support, with Rolling Stones singer Mick Jagger saying he was absolutely behind them. High profile backing to turn the red carpet green.
Robert Sutton Mattox. Finally, people in India have reacted with pride and sympathy to a video of the Prime Minister Narendra Modi hugging the tearful chairman of India's space research organisation, hours after India failed to land a probe on the moon. A journalist tweeted that it was the group hug of a billion plus people. Many on social media in Pakistan mocked India with the Twitter hashtag #IndiaFailed. prompting an immediate response from across the border with the hashtag #WorthlessPakistan. Here's our South Asia editor, Jill McGivering.
It was as the Indian lander started its descent to the moon's surface that disaster struck. Indian scientists looked devastated as they made a solemn announcement. Contact had been lost. It's a measure of the importance of this mission that the Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, attended in person, his role now to comfort rather than congratulate India's team. He did his best to cheer a grieving nation.
India is certain that there will be many more opportunities to be proud and rejoice. We are full of confidence that when it comes to our space program, the best is yet to come.
This is about far more than space. The moon mission is part of India's attempt to prove to itself and others that it's an emerging superpower, on a par with the West and its regional rival China. Critics have questioned the government's increase in spending on space, when millions of Indians still live in poverty. But supporters say India's programmes cost a fraction of US and Chinese ones and are an investment in the country's future.
Jill McGivering. And that is all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can. Just send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Claire McDonnell, and until next time, goodbye.